Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited for this week's show. It's our first show of 2023, which means it is our annual rundown of our favorite movies of the year, our top 10 movies of 2022, which means I'm joined for this very special episode, as always, by the man behind the song, JB.
Hooray for Hollywood.
And Adam Risky.
Burn, Hollywood, burn.
I'm getting very mixed messages from the both of you.
You're a mediator.
Happy New Year, guys.
Happy New Year to you, too. So this Happy is the New show Year. About Babylon? I missed that first part. We're talking about Babylon,
this
right?
is the Babylon episode, yeah.
Okay. Hey, we're not going to talk about Babylon for a number of reasons, unless it comes up in the conversation. I came to the conclusion, I think this was yesterday, that Babylon left such a bad taste in my mouth. I needed a film to wash it away.
Mind Cage.
And the film I chose was Inglourious Basterds, which worked really well to get the taste of Babylon out of my mouth. How was Mind Cage?
I described it to Rob as 75 minutes of The Silence of the Lambs, 15 minutes of Fallen, and 5 minutes of The Hays Code, Crime Can't Win.
So Adam just recreated for you the pitch meeting at the studio that got that film bankrolled.
For a movie that's ostensibly about serial killers, it does a complete 180 in the last like 5 minutes where they're just like, no, this you have to leave the theater happy.
Really on Wednesday, when you texted me the title screen on your TV, mm-hmm. I think that's the loudest I've laughed in a really long time.
I laughed even louder because I listened to your show before I texted you that picture. And it's not like I rented it as a challenge. I already had it rented. I just didn't watch it yet.
I think if I had been a little bit more clever in my choices, I could have found 10 films that no one had seen. I'm still waiting for the brave soul to come forward who has seen Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. That's what no one's talking about. Ooh, yeah. Strangely silent on the Mrs. Harris.
Mm-hmm. Like a title that rhymes. So we're going to count down our 10 favorite movies of the year, starting at number 10. And as always, if someone has the movie higher up on his list, we will wait to have the discussion until we get to its highest placement on any of our lists.
Or if we are told to table the conversation by our higher ups.
Correct. Yes.
That there's some sort of censorship going on.
I, for one, welcome our new ant overlords. J-Bones, you want to go first?
Sure. You know, it's so rare that an animated film makes my list. This made me so happy this year that my number 10 film is DC League of Super Pets.
Hey!
Okay, just joking. I'm trying to bring back the spirit of Doug Schultz, who we love and who used to come to this podcast every year with fake movies that would make us laugh.
They were real movies, just not movies that were actually on his top 10 list.
That he would put them... I will say one of my best film-going moments of this year, though, was going to the theater that's closest to my new house, and there was a dad there with his little four-year-old daughter, and clearly he had decided to take her to this film, but he played the game where he was, like, letting her pick what film they were going to see and doing that whole thing, and he was holding her in his arms, and she said in her adorable little voice,
Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. Oh.
And
Mind Cage, Daddy.
So I was all the kids want to see Mind Cage.
Yeah.
So it would that warmed my heart that they were going to see something and she was excited about it. My 10th favorite film this year is a tie, and I promise I won't have any more of these, but these two films go together. As I mentioned last week, it might be the feel-bad, creepy double feature of the year. My number 10 is a double feature of Men and Resurrection.
You could talk about Men.
And I recommend that you do see these two films together. That I would like to talk to you after one of our listeners watched them together. So I will talk about Men. even though I talked about Men last week, it's a very interesting indie horror film. I don't want to give much of it away. After our conversation last week, I looked up Jessie Buckley because I was so impressed with her performance. And I came to the conclusion, or actually I came to the conclusion that IMDb is very useful, that she was the female lead, and I'm Thinking of Ending Things. She was the handler in the Renee Zellweger, Judy Garland biopic, Judy. And she was Queen Victoria in Doolittle. So here's my takeaway. Jessie Buckley was in Doolittle and Rebecca Hall was in Holmes and Watson. So no matter how low your career sinks, stick with it. Mm-hmm. Because eventually you'll get to star in Men and Resurrection. The two films actually have a lot in common. We'll talk about Resurrection in a bit, but really well done, really well written, avoiding every Hollywood cliche you think they're going to fall into. You keep thinking you know where it's going, but especially in the case of Men, you have no idea where this is going. So that's a tie, and that's my number 10.
I like Alex Garland, but I still haven't seen Men.
Oh, Adam, have you seen Men?
I did see Men.
And?
He's giving the gentleman silence.
No. I'll reserve the gentleman silence for later. I can talk about Men. I liked the first two-thirds of it quite a bit. It lost me in the last act, but I think it's a pretty good movie.
In the last act, it just goes crazy, but that's one of the things I liked about it. And so few horror films anymore are able to scare me or creep me out. And a certain actor playing a creepy 10-year-old, courtesy of special effects, is one of the creepiest things I've ever seen in my life, especially what the script has him saying.
Is it Martin Short and Clifford?
I don't know. Oh, Martin Short and Clifford.
It is the evil Martin Short, Clifford, though it is not Clifford and it's not played by Martin Short. Again, I don't want to give stuff away, but Men really stuck with me.
So the conversation since 1994, and like Clifford is just good now, right?
I've never seen Clifford, but it seems like people like it.
Neither have I.
It's pretty good. It's like kind of that Happy Madison thing where it's sneaky good.
Right.
Were people disappointed in 94 because they went and there was no big red dog?
Probably.
I think people were just baffled at, like, why am I watching a movie in which Martin Short plays a 10-year-old?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. There Adam, seemed to be like.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No,
there
go
seemed
ahead.
To be more. There seemed to be more of a thing back in the 90s where critics and the public were like, you shouldn't be doing this.
Right.
And like now it's just kind of like, yeah, whatever.
Adam, what is your 10?
The Banshees of Inisherin.
Which we should discuss a little bit later. It is also on my list. It is higher up.
Cool.
All right, then. My 10 is the movie I wrestled with because I had 9 movies that I felt okay about. And as of an hour ago, I didn't have a number 10. So I finally settled on a movie for which Adam will most likely take the gentleman's silence. And that is Tommy Wirkola's Violent Night. There are better movies that certainly came out. And yet I feel like this movie was very me in a lot of ways. It reminded me a little bit of Turbo Kid in the way that it combines sort of genuine heartfelt sentiment and mean-spirited violence. I thought the movie had a lot of things that it had to do to be successful. I thought it balanced those two tones very well in terms of being like a legitimate action movie and a legitimate sentimental Christmas movie. I thought they did a nice job of coming up with a lot of like Santa related or Christmas related gags for gore and violence, which I'm always a fan of. It's that killer clowns rule. I thought David Harbour was a lot of fun. I thought John Leguizamo seemed to be having a good time as the villain. There's a Home Alone section about 2/3 of the way through the movie that I thought was very amusing. It's a little over long, which is probably a refrain that will come up again and again on this podcast, because movies in general were pretty long this year. And I think it sags a little bit in the middle, but it was just a movie that I kind of wanted to go to bat for on my top 10 list.
And I must say, it's a triumph of marketing, because I resisted Violent Night and I haven't seen it yet. But I will say this, I'm at the point now post-Christmas where there isn't a whole lot to see, because I've seen all the stuff I wanted to see for this podcast. And based on things I've read and things I've seen, it's slowly creeping up that I need to see it. So I feel like I resisted it. And now your recommendation is the opposite of the last nail in the coffin. Your recommendation will guarantee that I see it, especially since it's still in theaters.
Well, we're at a point where like the world is ending, because the other day I put on Scrooged because I hadn't seen it in a long time. And Scrooged opens with this like parody of a shitty Christmas movie in which Santa is running around with a gun teaming up with Lee Majors. And here it is, 2022, and we're just actually making that movie, right? And 30 Rock makes jokes about MILF Island, and now there's a show on like the Learning Channel that's basically MILF Island.
That's very close, yeah.
Yeah, like the stuff that we used to cynically predict was the bottom of the barrel entertainment has now become the actual entertainment. And Violent Night,
as we mentioned last week, with each passing year, Scrooged seems better.
I don't know if I'm there, but
okay. Adam is shaking his head no.
Scrooged is a middle finger to A Christmas Carol, and that's why I hate it.
It's a messy, messy film.
I think Violent Night could have gone wrong in a lot of ways. I think it could have been too hip or too smartassy. I think it could have been too sort of treacly and nonsensically cute in a way that didn't jive with the action stuff. I thought they handled the balance very well. So that's my number 10.
Well, one thing I wanted to mention, because I forgot until you mentioned it, that Tommy Vercola directed Violent Night.
Yeah.
And this is on topic, but not on topic. I was doing the box office game today, and it was like a weekend in February of 2013, and Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters was on the top five. And I did not know that that movie grossed like $250 million worldwide.
I did not know that either. Holy cow.
It made like five times its budget back.
Wow.
How did they not make another one?
I was going to say, we got robbed of a sequel. I'm guessing Renner was the holdout.
Probably. Well, he's the perfect distraction.
I still remember when that came out, and everyone's reaction was, oh my god, this is so much better than anyone had any thought that it could possibly be in any lifetime.
It's really good. And I also like that Silent Night, or Violent Night rather, is the screenplay works in terms of like it sets things up and pays them off. And it gives characters like enough of an arc. I mean, these are things that we've seen disappear out of American movie making. So that was just something else I wanted to mention. Jay Bones, I believe we are at your nine.
My number nine film. You know, Mark Wahlberg gets a lot of shit for some of the roles he picks. But I was so proud this year that Father Stu could be my number. Okay, I'm joking again.
I thought it was going to be a tie between Father Stu and Father Stu Reborn.
I'm reborn, bro.
Can you explain
bro?
This to me? Because Father Stu was in theaters before I moved, And then suddenly at my local theater, Father Stu shows up again. And I was like, is that the original? What did they re-release?
The studio wanted to make sure you always had a Father Stu to go see.
Is it two movies?
No, it's a PG-13 cut of an R-rated movie.
They cut out all the curse words, bro.
But you need the curse words to show what his life was like before he came to the Lord.
I don't want to hear the dirty words. I just want to hear Mel Gibson seething contempt for my religion.
And then in somewhere in Father Stu, I would like to hear Mark Wahlberg apologize for The Happening. Can we have that in both versions?
Yeah.
Okay, all kidding aside, my number 9 film is The Fablemans.
That's higher on my list.
Okay, and so we will keep going. Adam, what is your number 9?
My number 9 is Top Gun Maverick.
Go for it.
John, is that higher on your list?
It is not.
Okay. I saw writing. I was confused. So
I'm making a paper list of your films of the two of you. So I have a copy.
Okay.
Is that okay?
No.
As long as you burn it after the show.
Then I'll stop immediately.
So I liked there's not a lot of reasons to make legacy sequels, but I think that Top Gun Maverick had a good excuse because you can do a lot more with jet fight photography and cinematography between 1986 and 2022. So I think that the movie really took advantage of that. I appreciated how clean the storytelling was. You knew exactly what was going on in the mission. At all times, they set it up, whether it be in the mission briefings or the test run, so that by the time that you got to the climax, it was just sort of like innate that you knew kind of what was happening. It was easy to get wrapped up in the action. And then I liked it because it's this meta commentary about movie stars, and it kind of uses the Top Gun instructor as like, I'm the movie star, and Jennifer Connelly supporting him is I'm the movie star, and Val Kilmer, I'm a movie star with gravitas. And it's sort of like teaching these young bucks. It's like, if you want to play in this blockbuster game, this is what you need to do. This is the charisma you need to exude. This is how much you need to care about it. And I thought kind of from, you know, a textual and a metatextual stance, it really worked. I don't think it's a perfect movie. There's stuff in it that I have gripes with, namely kind of the treatment of the Val Kilmer Iceman character and not bringing Meg Ryan back. But those are nitpicks in the grand scheme of things. And I just think it's a very rewatchable movie. And that's why I put it at number 9.
I'm so glad that you did, because I'm glad that it's represented on this list. It's really the movie of the year and deserves to be talked about. There's so much in the movie that I like. I love that you talked about the clean storytelling, because I remember seeing it opening day, and like as they were doing the test run, I was like, oh my God, this is so smart. Like, movies just don't do this anymore, especially big action movies. I've said my piece about Top Gun Maverick already, but I do feel like this is the one I will revisit a lot more than the original Top Gun, which is not to throw shade at the original Top Gun. I think there was more for, you know, a lot of what I am not crazy about is the callbacks to the original film. I wish it had been willing to stand on its own just a little bit more. But the aerial stuff and all the combat photography, all that stuff is just incredible.
Yeah. I'm surprised, 'cause like, even though it, you know, it begs for comparison, I never really ever thought to say, do I like Top Gun or Top Gun Maverick better? Mm-hmm. It just seems like, you know, a worthy successor in the stance that, like, if I'm watching Top Gun, now I have to watch Top Gun Maverick.
Sure.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Are we up to my 9 then? Mm-hmm. What is my 9? My 9 is Senior. The Robert Downey Sr. documentary that premiered on Netflix a couple of months ago, directed by Chris Smith in participation with Robert Downey Jr. I talked about this on the show a few weeks ago, so I won't say a whole lot about it, except that I have maybe seen one Robert Downey Sr. movie. So I come to this documentary not necessarily as a fan of his brand of counterculture underground comedy, but more so just as a fan of him as a as an individual spirit, for what he represents in filmmaking and for what the movie has to say about art and fathers and sons. I think the structure of the film is really interesting in that it, at a certain point, it sort of splinters off into two separate documentaries, one that Senior is making and one that Junior is making. I thought it was really, really good and could have just been sort of a vanity project, but ends up being this sort of beautiful last movement in his career and a way of saying goodbye to him, I think, in a meaningful way.
It's the number one reason I'm upset that I canceled Netflix, because I really want to see it. Is the Robert Downey Sr. film you've seen Putney Swope?
No, I think it's like Up the Academy.
Oh, I keep forgetting he directed that. Yeah. And of course, you know him from his great scene in Boogie Nights.
That's a YP.
Yes, not a UP. I really want to see it. I'm not sure if it's available on physical media yet, as we discovered when we had our Munsters adventure. But I don't really miss Netflix, but I really want to see that movie.
Yeah, it's really special. I thought it was really, really good. J-Bones, you're 8?
You know, gentlemen, sequels hardly ever make people's 10 best list. But this year, Hocus Pocus 2 was so special. And so, and at this point, Patrick should extend the joke by saying that we have to table our discussion of Hocus 2 because it's higher up on his list. Okay, all kidding aside.
I'm glad that Walgreens is represented on this list.
Hocus Pocus 2, brought to you by Walgreens. What's the verb I'm looking for here? I wrestled with the next one because when I saw it the first time, I really hated it. And then I read a piece of film criticism that made me reassess the film. And when's the last time that film criticism made you do that? It certainly suffers from this year's malady of over length, but my number 8 film is Tar. I'm sorry, say that again.
I have not seen it.
And Patrick?
I said go for it.
Okay. This is a serious film about a serious subject, maybe a too serious film about a too serious subject. But there was a piece published on Slate. I can't immediately think of the author, which is a shame because it's a brilliant piece of film criticism. And he suggested that everyone was misreading the third act of the film. And he gave his interpretation, which in a very humble way, he said, this might not be it, but this is something I've noticed. And he backed up his claim with evidence from the film. And it really made me go back and reassess the film. And I like it a lot better now because I don't think it's solely about one thing. It's about a number of things. And you certainly can't argue with, even if you hated the film, you have to give Kate Blanchett some credit for giving a performance that you've never seen before. I would suggest that everyone see this film because, again, it's not DC League of Super Pets or Father Stew or Hocus Pocus 2. It's this important big film of the year. But then read the Slate article because it'll make you reassess the film as well. The criticism that I'm talking about sort of recasts the film as a horror film. And I like Tar a lot better as a horror film than a Hollywood social problem film.
The article that you're talking about is by Dan Coyce, I believe is his name.
Yes.
Which I read after I saw the movie, and it didn't necessarily make me like or appreciate the movie anymore. This was one of those movies that I saw and said, I recognize why that is very good, but I just never felt a connection to it.
No, the first time I saw it, it drove me crazy. It literally drove me crazy as it was unspooling in the theater. I so actively disliked it. Or maybe it was the case that it was making me feel uncomfortable, which, of course, is one of the things it was trying to do. Mm-hmm. But I was amazed when I read the Slate piece how many things I missed, how many things completely eluded me. And certainly some of those things are hidden, but some of them are not. Mm-hmm. And if anything, it showed me that I need to be, maybe because I was not enjoying myself so much, I sort of turned myself off.
Sure.
And clearly one should never do that, especially if they're paying for the pleasure of watching the film.
I haven't seen Tar, but I want to mention this phenomenon that you're talking about, John, because you did this for me on a movie this year where your reaction to it made me like the movie a lot more. It's not on my list, but you did that with Halloween Kills. Or Halloween Ends. Sorry.
I remember liking Halloween Ends more than a lot of people.
Yeah. I was like on the fence, and then we did a reserve seating and we were talking about it, I think off camera. And I don't know. You just kind of, tapped into something that I was sort of like not really consciously thinking about. So thank you, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
You're welcome.
And thank you for saving those. Thank you for saving those brilliant insights for off camera and not sharing them on the website.
You're welcome. It was the Scared Halloween review. We were. I don't know.
Speaking of Spirit Halloween, Adam, what is your number 8?
The Fablemans.
It's higher on my list.
Okay.
My 8 is a movie that I tabled. It was JB's number 10, and that is Resurrection. Resurrection is sort of a fringe horror movie because I deliberately didn't put much horror on my list. I have a couple of like fringy horror movies, but for like straight horror, I wanted to save it until I do the show with Heather, hopefully next week. But Resurrection, I thought, had the performance, I won't say the performance of the year, but Rebecca Hall gives one of the performances of the year, I would say, in Resurrection.
It's amazing. I think it's matched by Tim Roth.
Tim Roth is great. Yeah. But to me, it was the Rebecca Hall show, and she's always good, but I think this is the best part she's ever been given as a woman who is possibly
better than Godzilla versus Kong.
Not quite better. It's more of a lateral move. She's maybe being gaslit by her ex-husband who re-enters her life and causes her to relive all this past trauma. There's a monologue scene in the movie that will be talked about forever. And again, I give the movie lots of credit for going where it goes. We talked about this a little bit, I think, on the Overrated Underrated show, the Hunter Award for going there. I couldn't have predicted much of this movie, and yet I was sort of gripped the entire time. Again, in large part because of the Rebecca Hall performance and the Tim Roth performance, because he's very creepy and upsetting without really ever being creepy and upsetting, because he's not she's saying he is. And that's upsetting
to us. Which is what I was marveling at, that he avoids the cliche.
Yeah.
And that there's this complicated ambiguity going on in the entire film that I really wish more films were comfortable with.
Yeah. I'm sorry, J Bones. I didn't mean to step on you because you had this at number 10. So is there anything that you want to say about it?
No, I think you covered it in that the three of us have seen a lot of movies. And when something like this manages to avoid Hollywood convention and avoid cliche and go in a direction that we didn't expect, I give it a lot of credit. Because in our case, we're comparing it to hundreds of other films we've seen. I would argue that it's possible to watch and discuss Resurrection not as a horror film at all.
Sure.
It certainly has some horror film tropes.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I liked about it was that the director didn't go all in on the horror aspects and sort of held back on that so that you didn't have that to fall back on. Certainly, Resurrection manages to do that better than Men. It's very difficult to watch Men and not conclude that this is a horror film of some sort. But Resurrection could sort of be in that subgenre of, is the protagonist crazy or is her world really being turned upside down in reality?
100%. I would argue that there is a point at which, very near the end of the film, it undeniably becomes a horror movie. But up until that point, I completely agree with you.
Okay. And I think I know the point you're talking about.
Yeah.
But again, compared to DC League of Super Pets, Father Stew, and Hocus Pocus 2, our listeners need to seek out Resurrection. I mean, this is one of the films that you should treasure this year.
It's on Shudder.
Which I'm guessing our listeners have. Shudder turns out to be just the best bargain in terms of what you pay to what you get.
Right.
What is it, $5 a month? Good
I
Lord.
Believe so, yeah. Although I expect that to probably change pretty soon with all the shakeups at AMC Plus.
I'll pay a little bit more as long as they bring Joe Bob back.
Yeah.
So are we on 7?
We're on 7, yeah.
Okay. Last week we talked about the fact that Hollywood has a problem with comedies, and comedies are very hard to pull off to begin with, and then if you make a whole bunch of bad ones, blah, 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 blah. But this was an amazing comedy, and I'm through joking around with my choices. Weird. The Al Yankovic story? I expected this quickie streaming service cash-in. Roku's in the movie business. And man, it's an amazing film for a number of reasons. Number one is I think they shot it in 18 days or something. It has a script that's actually clever with jokes that will make you laugh, although that shouldn't surprise us because all three of us are fans of UHF, which is a movie with lots of actual funny jokes. Dan Radcliffe wouldn't be my first choice to play Weird Al, but my God, what a performance. It's so funny. It's so clever. It's a wonderful send-up of biopics, but it's also sort of sincere in its own way. It does a whole bunch of things effortlessly, and I think it's the single best time I had at the movies this year.
And you, did you go to the Beyond Fest screening of this?
No, I did not. I had to watch it at home.
Okay. I wondered if that influenced how much fun you had with it. You had more fun with it than I did.
I was having that weird thing where since I don't subscribe to Netflix, I had to go out to a Target far away and buy a copy of The Munsters. But one of our listeners informed me that Roku had an app that you could download so I could actually watch it the day it came out. And from what I understand, like if they dropped it at midnight, lots of people were there right at midnight, sort of attending the premiere of Weird on Roku. I loved it. I thought it was so funny.
Our friends, Lauren and Steve, said that they tried to watch it the night it came out, and they said it took them about 3 hours to get through it because it wouldn't stop buffering because so many people were watching it at the same time.
And remember, part of this is sentimental. I'm older than the two of you, and I grew up listening to Dr. Demento on Sunday night. That was a rite of passage. And to see him portrayed in a movie, and Rainn Wilson does such a great job of playing. I used to know Dr. Demento's real name, Barry something.
Demento.
Barry Pimento. It was just wonderful. It avoided every trap of being this quickie streaming service cash-in. We need content, gentlemen. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, there were times where it felt a little bit like a Funny or Die sketch to me, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but there were enough inspired jokes and ideas, and in particularly Evan Rachel Wood performance as Madonna. And just, it's fun to play, hey, look who shows up in the movie, you know, when he goes to the pool party and all these famous comedians are playing sort of famous pop culture misfits. You have Paul F. Tompkins playing Gallagher, and I had fun with it. I didn't love it as much as you. I found myself wishing they would have just let Weird Al make another movie, another sort of UHF, rather than a movie about Weird Al where he's played by somebody else. But I'm happy to hear it show up on the list. Next, Adam, you're seven.
My seven is Armageddon Time. Okay. So, all right. Sorry. I had to look at my notes. I apologize. I appreciated that. I don't know. I think this movie's like hits me specifically because it's got like some really complicated Jewish characters in it. It deals with a lot of things within Judaism, like Jewish classism and Jewish politics, especially. It's really stuck with me since I've seen it. I kind of heard going into the movie that it was like this damaged goods awards movie, which is almost like the best way to go in to see a movie, because then the expectation of it like just being a perfect spotless masterpiece is off the table and you can kind of just enjoy the movie for what it is. But it's really stuck with me. It's just like such a sad movie in so many ways. And one of the things that I thought was interesting was they promoted the movie really kind of playing up the scene between Anthony Hopkins and the kid, and the Anthony Hopkins character, he's the grandfather, and he's like the prototypical mensch character where it's, you know, you're a good person, you always do the right thing and everything like that. And the thing I think is interesting about
No, you said always do the right thing. I said that's it. That's it.
Got it.
Oh, I'm going to turn my hat around because then maybe it'll free up the brain. But I thought that scene was really interesting because it's the trailer moment to make you think it's this inspirational movie, and it's really not. I mean, like, the thing that is interesting about it, and I'm not spoiling anything, is at the end of the movie, the kid has another conversation with the Anthony Hopkins character, and it doesn't go as perfectly as planned. And the Anthony Hopkins character is basically like, yeah, well, you'll get him next time. And it sort of like reveals like this is wisdom of a guy who's near the end of his life. He's passing on like these truisms, but they're not always realistic. And I thought that it was interesting because where the kid is left at the end of the movie is sort of like where so many of us are left in life, where it's like, can we even really do anything with the best intentions? Because the system stacks so much against us. And, you know, it's not even like a cynical movie. It's just like a movie that's just kind of exasperated and sad. And there's so many things in it that are just these really sad microaggressions that happen. Like one of the things that's, it's not even like underlined, but, you know, the Jeremy Strong character says, you know, I really liked your grandfather, the Anthony Hopkins character. Like he really stuck out, he looked out for me and everything like that, even though my family was more working class than Anne Hathaway, who's his wife's family. And he's saying this in the car because the family won't let him be at the gravesite at the funeral. And it's like whatever protection he had is gone. And it's not something that's really called attention to, but it's hard to shake once you realize what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole movie's like that. I used to give James Gray a lot of crap because I thought that like his movies were made for the film comments crowd. And I gotta say, like, the guy's getting to me. Like he's made some movies that's really kind of, you know, touched my heart. And I feel bad about giving him such grief, but I think Armageddon Time is a really underrated movie.
And Adam, were you able to see it in a theater?
Yeah.
Because around here, there's one theater that fancies itself a little bit more high class than the other theaters, and that's the only theater that film played at.
Yeah.
The it's one available for like digital rental and purchase if you're interested in seeing it.
Yeah, I think it's coming out for like rental the first weekend of January. So you can, if you wait a couple of more days, you'll pay $5 or $6 instead of 20.
Right.
Or I can go to the Roxy 10 in Camarillo.
Mm-hmm.
Is John Deal, that's his name, right? Is he one of those actors that freaks you out, Adam? Why did I have that in my head? That when he showed
up, freaks me
Fred,
out?
Yeah, when he showed up playing, like maybe from our Mo Money conversation or something. Because when he showed up playing Fred Trump, I was like, oh, this is a double nightmare for Adam.
Yeah. The Fred Trump of it, when I realized it was Fred Trump, the movie took on a whole other like level. It's like kind of one of the most like stomach-churning surprises, I suppose, of the year in movies.
No, way worse is the actress who shows up to play Marianne Trump, because it gives me the weirdest boner.
Oh, Anne Hathaway gave me one of those in this movie. Patricia Clarkson in Far From Heaven. Kirsten Dunst in Hidden Figures. I am no stranger to the racist boner. John Deal, like specifically, I think in Mo Money that bothers me, because Mo Money should be like this strictly business, like fun comedy. And then John Deal's just like
playing a psychopath. Right?
I'm just like, oh no, please, you're a little too scary for this action comedy. And he's just like, fuck you, you're dying. And I'm just like, yeah, he's like if Art the Clown showed up in Mo Money.
More movies this year needed Art the Clown. I went into Armageddon Time knowing only you had liked it, because the reviews I had read or caught wind of were kind of down on the movie, but I knew you were a fan, so I wanted to see it, and I ended up really liking it. I just felt so sad for the two boys. I thought the two boys were like so adorable, and this movie is like the Passion of the Christ, just in terms of like putting them through the paces and getting them into trouble. And I felt so sad for them. I mean, I kind of feel sad for almost everybody in the movie. And like you, maybe warming to James Gray between finally catching up with the Yards, liking Ad Astra, and now liking this, I may be doing a turnaround.
There's so much like hypocrisy in the movie too. It's like easy to get like really worked up and angry, because it's like, you know, Anne Hathaway's like the president of the school board, and she's got a child just like hanging out in her like shed, and she just could not be less aware of what's going on.
Right.
Or, you know, like the Jewish families, you know, horrified that Reagan's about to win the presidency, but then their idea of upward mobility is sending their child to the Trump boarding school.
Right.
It's weird. Yeah.
I thought this movie made a better use of fake Trumps than She Said.
Yeah.
Which had the James Austin Johnson doing his Trump impression on the phone. I was like, well, this takes me out of it. When you have the guy from SNL doing his Trump impression.
Yeah. That does show how indelible it is, though, and how unique it is. Because as I'm watching She Said, I thought to myself, that's James Austin Johnson. And I stayed for the credits and I got it.
Yeah.
I changed my mind. Armageddon Time is my number four. It's my
number.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I changed it. I flipped it.
Do you want to talk about your new number seven?
No, I'll wait. I'll talk about that at four.
Okay. Got it. Just remind us when we get to four that you're actually talking about your seven and Armageddon Time is your four.
Got it.
My seven is the other fringe horror movie on my list, and it's a lot more straightforward horror than Resurrection. And that is Luca Guadagnino's Bones and All, which is the first Luca movie I've fully been able to embrace, I think because it takes all the stuff I like from Call Me By Your Name about relationships and sort of coming of age, and all the stuff I really like from Suspiria, which is violence and horror and people killing each other, and it combines them into one movie where we get this beautiful, moving, coming of age young adult romance. and people eating people. And I thought it was a really gorgeous film. Great performances by Timothy Chalamet and Taylor Russell, Adam, as you pointed out in our column last week. Really gorgeous photography. I'm not the first person to bring up, like, the two movies that get mentioned the most, I think, in conversation about Bones and All are Near Dark and Badlands. And any movie that can invoke those two films, I think, is worth your time. Variety called it one of the worst movies of the year. So that's how you know it's good. I thought this was really a special film.
I like how many people on the Twitter machine posted that Variety thing to shit on it, that they only posted it to heap derision on it. Now, Patrick, you got to help me out because I'm now in a position of ignorance. I'm very confused. The gentleman who directed Call Me By Your Name.
Yes.
Directed the Suspiria remake.
Correct.
And he also did Bones and All.
Correct.
I was not aware of any of that.
Yeah.
That really makes me want to see Bones and All.
It's really good. Yeah, I don't know. I think I like it even more than Near Dark, even though it kind of does the same. You know, that's the one that it reminded me of the most. And then you kind of put Badlands in my head, and I can totally see that too. But I like that, you know, despite it being this kind of salacious, you know, subject matter and everything like that, like, it really could be about, like, any, it could be about, like, the couple from American Honey, you know?
Sure.
It's, like, just really, like, taking a look at these kids who just kind of, you know, are on the outskirts of society and kind of, like, how they make their day and, you know, just the fact that their semblance of normalcy is just because they found each other. Otherwise, right, they're, you know, freaks in the woods and everything like that. And
which is kind of what all of his movies have been about so far. This idea of, I'm an outsider finding someone or some people with whom I can finally fit in.
Yeah. Yeah. He's really good at the horror genre too, in a way that, like, you know, doesn't beg for accolades or attention, I guess. Like, yeah. I don't think within the horror community he's, you know, kind of fawned upon like some of the other some of his other contemporaries. And I don't mean that as a negative. I just think that, like, he's not given sort of the appreciation that I think he deserves just yet in that genre.
I was a big fan of the Suspiria remake. I like that movie more than anyone else I know.
It's really good.
I think this is a movie that, again, as I think it's going to be the horror audience that ends up rescuing this movie, mm-hmm, as they begin to discover it.
As often happens.
Yeah. I don't think mainstream audiences are going to jive with it quite as much because it is a little bit out there and there are moments of, like, holy shit kind of violence. But I'm excited for horror fans to discover it because I think there's a lot to love here. All right.
So we're on John 6, right?
Yeah, John 6.
Okay.
And I have to say, I only saw this film because P. Bromley Esquire recommended it. And then all of a sudden, the Twitter machine was abuzz with people talking about how good it is. And I said, how good could it be? So my wife and I watched it. And it's called Ambulance. And I would argue, it, we'll talk about it later, but I want to say it's the action film of the year, and we'll talk about it in a bit.
Yeah. So that brings us to Adam, your six.
My six is,
he's trying to decide what his six is, everyone.
No, I just, numbers are hard. No, I'll go with my number six is Avatar: The Way of Water.
Tabled.
Okay, tabled.
I'll be brief on my six because I don't think either of you saw it. It is Park Chan-wook's Decision to Leave, the best film noir of the year. A man dies on a mountain, perhaps accidentally, perhaps not.
So it's just like It's a Mad, 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 Mad World?
Exactly. A police officer begins to investigate and finds himself drawn to the woman who may have committed a murder. It has some of the best photography of the year. It definitely has the best editing of any movie this year. It is beautiful. I need to see it again because even watching it the first time, I was like, I don't know that I got everything that I should have gotten out of this movie. So I'm excited. It's streaming now on Mubi, which I don't know anybody that has, unless you subscribe through Pure Cinema or Video Archives. But I'm really anxious for it to come out on Blu-ray because I really, really want to revisit it.
There's a there was a screening at Beyond Fest that sold out instantly because Park Chan-wook was there and did a Q&A after the film. And there's a theater pretty close to my new place where like one Thursday a month, they have, oh, this is for serious movie lovers. And Decision to Leave was the film last month that they showed. I haven't seen it yet. I know Jan and Jake did get tickets to the Park Chan-wook triple feature that preceded the screening of Decision to Leave. But all I've heard is amazing things about it. It's supposed to be great.
It's very, very good. So now we are in the upper half, top five, Jay Bones.
My number five film, which I actually got to see in a theater because I took advantage of its 1 week of theatrical screenings, is Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery.
Which is higher on my list.
Okay. That makes me happy.
Yeah.
Because opinion, once it hit Netflix, opinion has been divided.
Twitter has been determined to make me not like it.
Yeah, which I can't figure out. In any case, Adam, what's your number five?
My number five is a movie that I think I had the most fun with in a theater all year. I saw it completely by myself the Thursday it opened. It shocked me in a lot of ways that I wasn't expecting, which I'll get into. That movie's Ty West X. I did not know who played the old woman until I saw the end credits. And my mind was blown, and I wanted to run out of the theater and just tell everybody and shake them and be like, I just saw the most amazing double performance. I had no idea I was watching it. And then, like, they had the stinger for Pearl at the end of the movie, which I didn't know about. And it's like, it was such a present. It's like this movie that's your favorite movie of the year up to that point, and there's just like there's a sequel that they made in secret, and it's just like it's coming out, like it's done, it's coming out soon. So that was so great. I liked that Ty West was just back. Yeah. Directed a movie in quite a long time. He went to television. I think he came back sort of a looser director, which was interesting because he's more playful now almost than he was before, where I really love like House of the Devil, especially, and The Innkeepers too. But those movies were very controlled and kind of precise. And I felt like this one was a little bit shaggier, and it seemed like he was having a really good time making just kind of a sexy slasher movie. It had like career best performances for me from like Brittany Snow and Martin Henderson and Mia Goth and, yeah, I don't know. I only put it down at five and not higher because I think a movie that is higher on my list makes me like X a little bit less, and I'll explain that when I get to that movie.
I loved X. I'm so glad you mentioned Martin Henderson and Brittany Snow because they were both actors who have never really done anything for me in the past. And to watch them get parts this fun and to watch them like dig in the way they do was so, so entertaining. Mia Goth was not on my radar at all. And between this and her other film this year, it's like, holy shit, Mia Goth can do it all. I love that this is the year that like Jenna Ortega became a scream queen. I loved X from the opening shot. I couldn't go see X when it came out. Because I had COVID, and so I had to wait several weeks, but I did manage to see it theatrically, and it's certainly one of my favorite horror movies this year. I think it's so good.
Yeah. Do you need to see Pearl to enjoy X?
No,
because I saw X before Pearl.
Everybody did.
Yeah. Not everybody.
Well, anybody who saw X at the time hadn't seen Pearl because it didn't exist yet.
I'm glad I challenged you on this.
My five or my four? What are we at?
You're five.
Yeah.
My five is going to be higher on at least one list, and that is The Menu.
Yeah, that's higher on my list.
Okay, so we will come back to that. JB, your
my four.
Four, yeah.
We talked about it at some length last week. My number four film is Confess, Fletch.
Nice.
Another example of a comedy that seems effortless, but we all know comedy is not effortless. Someone in the comments pointed out that it was so great that John Hamm found something to play beyond Don Draper, because he's obviously really talented and he deserves to be in movies that are not about adult men who play a game of tag.
That's a movie that exists.
That's a real movie that I didn't make up. And I'm not the biggest fan of Chevy Chase, but obviously Chevy Chase is really associated with playing Fletch. I thought John Hamm did it better. In whatever quantitative way you want to sort of say, how should this character be played? I thought Hamm did a better job, because there was always something very up its own ass and self-congratulatory about the way Chase played it. And it seems to me the character should be laid back, and John Hamm encapsulated that. It was really funny. It was a mystery that didn't, what's the word I'm looking for? If you want to watch it as a mystery, it plays fair and doesn't give that aspect of the story short shrift. It's got all these wonderful character actors doing wonderful turns. I only wish I had seen this in a theater.
Yeah.
But I streamed it.
I've never read any of the Fletch books, which I think we talked about when we talked about this movie the first time. So I couldn't say that like one person plays the part better or worse than the other, but John Hamm to me seems to be playing a character and making choices. And when I watch Chevy Chase, again, not having the book version to compare it to, it seems like Chevy Chase is just being Chevy Chase. I don't see him making choices as to who Erwin Fletcher is. He's just, well, I'm Chevy Chase and you're not, and I'm going to wear wacky disguises. Whereas John Hamm, I get a sense of who the Fletch character is. So if I have a preference, it's with the John Hamm version, if that makes sense.
This movie is so much fun.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping they make another one.
Not likely.
Really?
I don't think it made any money. So
wow, that's such a shame.
Yeah, it's weird that it kind of opened out of nowhere. There was no marketing for it. And Greg Mottola is a really good director, so maybe he can sort of drag one past the finish line, Riddick style, like if he can just sneak one by. We'll see, but I don't have high hopes right now. Good Lorenza Izzo too.
Who owns, because it was an Orion movie, right?
Yeah, I think Paramount put it out. I think Universal put out the original Fletch movies.
Yeah, I signed up for Showtime because it's like $1.99 for 2 months. And it's on there, so soon it will be go time on Showtime for me.
Adam, what is your number seven?
My number seven, which really fucked up in the past hour and dropped from six to seven. And
for those of you just joining us, this is his number four. Go back and start the podcast from the beginning.
So my number seven is Emily the Criminal.
Oh, nice.
Which we need to table for a few minutes.
Okay. Well, then that brings us to my four, which J Bones, now we can talk about, because it is Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery, arguably the worst title of the year. Because I guess Ryan Johnson agrees with me, because he wanted it to just be called Glass Onion. Mm-hmm. And Netflix insisted on calling it a Knives Out mystery, which Makes no goddamn sense. If anything, it's a Benoit Blanc mystery, not a Knives Out mystery, but whatever.
You're so desperate to establish a franchise.
J-Bone, since you mentioned this first, you should have first dibs on talking about it.
I went in with such tremendous trepidation because I love the original Knives Out film. So will they be able to make that bar, or will they go in a completely different direction and screw it up that way? I would be hard pressed to say which one I like better, but I was so impressed by so many of the things this film did. Now, I can't talk about all of them because it's a mystery and I don't want to give things away. In fact, one of my moments of the year in that column, my wife nicely rewrote so that it wouldn't be a spoiler, because one of my favorite moments of the year is something that happens in Glass Onion that you're not expecting. And I will not spoil it here. I thought it was interesting that when Glass Onion came out, all sorts of people on the Twitter machine were playing a game. Who do you want to see in the third one? Because A, it's a fun game to play. And B, it's nice that we have this thing that people enjoy that is using all these actors who are usually underserved and giving them something to play. I mean, Janelle Monáe in Glass Onion is so good in so many ways. It's such a clever performance. Last week, I mentioned Kate Hudson. There's a running joke involving Kate Hudson. Someone on the Twitter machine suggested it's one of the few films this year that actually mentioned COVID, because there's that great bit at the beginning when they all showed up masked. But because they're visiting a multi-billionaire, something is shot into their mouths, which is never explained. But the security guard who's doing it just keeps saying, "You're fine now." There's and I'm sitting in a theater wondering why I haven't gotten my shot to the mouth, because though I'm not a billionaire, the COVID's been with us for a couple of years. Anyway, this film has so many delights in it. Including some of the things that the main character has on display in that main room that he was able to borrow because of COVID from some museums and things. It's just, it's an endlessly fun thing. I think it's particularly fun if you like whodunits, if you like mysteries and detective stories. Certainly Benoit Blanc is right up there in the pantheon of great movie detectives. It was just so much fun.
Yeah, I have it at number four because it's maybe the most entertaining movie I saw this year. I thought the screenwriting was really, really terrific in terms of there's at least two mysteries that you think are the mystery that aren't the mystery.
Yes.
It has a great cast, obviously, and then gives them something to do, JB, as you pointed out. Whereas, you know, last week we talked about like Amsterdam, which is just here's a bunch of really famous people.
And it's just nonsense.
In a movie, right. And whereas this movie allows them to create characters and develop personalities. And Kate Hudson, to me, is the MVP because I just think everything she does is so funny. There's a great editing gag where Catherine Hahn is on TV talking about how serious COVID is. And the camera pans down and Kate Hudson is having this enormous maskless party. I thought Edward Norton was extremely funny playing a sort of tech bro douche. There's a running joke about Jeremy Renner's hot sauce, and I was like, well, this is a movie for me. Like, any movie that understands that Jeremy Renner's hot sauce is inherently funny is a movie for me. And so again, I don't want to play the game of do I like this more or less than Knives Out. You know, I liked Knives Out. I think they're similar in a lot of ways. I think this movie finds distinct ways to be different. It's definitely broader than Knives Out. The characters are more broadly drawn, but I don't think that's such a bad thing. It has a bigger scope. It's really beautifully designed and shot. The score is great. The performances are great. I was a big fan of the movie.
That's why I was glad I got to see this one in a theater, because it's on a scale and a scope, and it's very beautiful to look at.
Yeah. All right, we will move on then to our top three. JB, your three.
My number three film, which I mentioned last week, came out of the blue. I knew nothing about it. As Patrick and I said, this is the way to see every movie ever made. You are told the title. You are shoved into the theater. You sit down and the movie starts. And Twitter was never invented. My number three film is Emily the Criminal, which was so good in so many ways, including like a couple of the other films on my list. Just when you think you have a handle on what this film is about, it's kind of not what it's about. Adam, I'm speaking specifically of what we think of the gentleman who's the mastermind behind the whole credit card scam thing,
mm-hmm.
and what we think of him as the film goes along and there's other events and his character is revealed to be something else. And certainly Emily is revealed to be something other than what we first thought. I'm making it sound like it's a big mystery, but what I'm saying is I think we originally.
That's the power dynamic is completely off. Yeah,
exactly. I really gave the film credit for doing that in a subtle and interesting and convincing way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She Anakin Skywalkers him, if you will.
Very much.
She throws him into a pit of
lava. I also like all the stuff about being an intern, about how mm-hmm. the intern system favors the rich, because who on earth can take a year off to work for free?
Yeah.
And it's just another form of exploitation. And I thought all the crime stuff was honestly nerve-wracking and suspenseful. Obviously, I thought Aubrey Plaza's performance was amazing. I think both of you have heard about The White Lotus.
No.
She's one of the performers on season two.
Yeah.
And wow, we talked about this briefly last week. When you look at some of the movies she made, like The Bad Grandpa and the We Need Wedding Dates, mm-hmm. and then you look at a film like Ingrid Goes West or The White Lotus and the Emily the Criminal, it's like I said when that version of Much Ado About Nothing came out that one guy made in his backyard.
Yeah.
That it was mostly TV actors. And like that movie or hate that movie, when you watch it, you get to see what these actors are capable of once they're handed something that's not The Rookie.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I watched The Rookie once because my son's girlfriend used to work on post-production on it.
Is this a TV series?
It's a Nathan Fillion show on ABC.
It's about a much older man who decides to become a cop.
God.
And we watched this, and this is not the kind of TV show we normally watch. And I'm sorry I'm going off on a tangent, but it was purporting to present real life. And in no way, shape, or form did it resemble the way people talk, act, or behave.
No, it's a TV show.
It was like watching something from a foreign planet. You know, the cops and the organized crime people, they're actually friends. They actually get along. It's only when they have to. Anyway, Emily the Criminal was amazing.
Yeah, I like that. So Aubrey Plaza's around my age. She's in her, well, I'm a little older than her, but she's like in her late 30s. And one thing that I really like is that she's just gaining steam at that age, really, because that sort of ensures that she's not going to have roles dried up at a certain point in the near future. I think like she's so adept at just kind of fitting into whatever movie she's in, like whether it's like Ingrid Goes West or Emily the Criminal, where she can just be such a captivating lead, or like just kind of in Happiest Season where she walks in and she's like Joe Pesci in The Irishman, just like stealing the movie.
Yeah.
And I just think that she's so wonderful. I love Aubrey Plaza. And then I really appreciated just sort of like in increments, kind of how the story developed. Like I made a joke to you guys earlier, I think on the summer show, that like I could have settled for the movie being about Emily the caterer, because like just her like having this like, humdrum 9 to 5 is interesting enough. But then like the machinations of this credit card scheme and like how it just kind of, spirals out of control, or spirals in control almost in a way, is fascinating. And yeah, I mean, like I just love independent movies like this where they don't come to you with a lot of pomp and circumstance, and like, we're not supposed to throw rose petals at it when it gets, released. And you just sit there and you watch it and you're just like, yeah, this is just a good story, well told. And I wish there were tons more movies like this.
I love what you said about Happiest Season, because I remember sitting down and watching that with my wife. I think that would have been a year ago, Christmas.
Or two
And
years or
thinking,
something. Yeah, something like
was
that.
it really 2 years? Oh my God.
halfway through, why isn't this about the Aubrey Plaza character?
It's fucking insane that she goes with Mackenzie Davis at the end of that movie when it's like, what do you do? It's like, do you want Helen of Troy or Girl Who's Lying to You?
You're at the mercy of a script that's trying to be
Crazy.
something else.
And then another movie came out this year called Spin Me Round, in which once again we want the main character to end up with Aubrey Plaza, and they don't. And it's like, what the fuck are you thinking? The choice is clear. Anyway, Emily the Criminal, super good. Is it my four or my three? My three.
I didn't do my three yet.
Oh
You have to do
shit!
Adam's
Sorry,
three.
Adam. I'm sorry.
And I'm glad that you tried to skip me, because my number three is too hot for the internet. It is a movie that Patrick Bromley himself warned me away from.
Oh boy.
I said, "Do you think I would like the Terrifier movies?" And you
Oh,
said,
that's right.
"No." I went in September from being Terrifier Who to in October being my number three movie of the year is Terrifier 2. I had an experience with this movie unlike really any horror movie I can think of in recent years. Maybe Hatchet was the last one, where it was like this sort of just kind of underground movie that just kind of sprung up out of nowhere. And the difference between Hatchet and this one, though, is this almost felt like you needed to watch it to earn like horror street cred.
Ha
It was like pushing the envelope of like what you can handle. And I thought that that was really interesting, because like I watched the first Terrifier on streaming, and I was like, I don't want to be caught in a theater and like just be so grossed out where like I need to leave. So I watched the first Terrifier. I wasn't like crazy about it. I'm still not completely sold on that movie. But Terrifier 2 is, I described it, it's like if James Cameron made Terrifier. Like it's basically like he ups, like Damien Leone just ups the game so much compared to the first one. It's like a real like Rob Zombie to like Devil's Rejects type of jump. The movie itself, I watched like kind of white knuckled because I was so nervous about the gore, and I didn't do myself any favors by like, I was like, if I read about it and ha ahead of time, I'll be prepared for it. And then I read it like blow by blow, and I was just like, oh, I'm not going to handle this at all. But then when I'm watching the movie, what kind of really kind of crystallized for me was this is Herschel Gordon Lewis gore. It's like very, red and wet and gooey, but it's very silly in a lot of ways. And yet Art the Clown is terrifying. Like I mentioned this to you, I think, on the Patreon show recently, where unlike some of his fellow horror slasher brethren, it's like I'm nervous for the people in any scene that he appears in, because whatever he does, it's going to hurt really bad. And so I don't know, it kind of has it both ways in that regard. And then one thing that's kind of the masterstroke of the movie is Lauren Lavera's character, who is the protagonist and the final girl. And it just proves you can get away with anything, no matter how dark or violent or whatever, in a movie, as long as you give an audience the rooting interests
Yeah.
to have. And Terrifier 1 does not have that, and I think that's one of the reasons why it doesn't work nearly as well as Terrifier 2. Terrifier 2 expands it where there's a lot of new characters. We love them. Some of them survive. Some of them will presumably return for Terrifier 3. So it turns what is kind of like a, I don't know, into like a franchise I'm like really excited about. And I hope because, the movie theater industry is so barren right now that we have more opportunities, whether it be in horror or other genres, for movies to kind of just bust through and have go from having, no buzz to just being these word of mouth hits that kind of take over a theater for a couple of months. It was just kind of funny because, like, Halloween Kills is like the marquee horror movie of October, but everybody who follows the genre really like talked about that for a couple of days, and everybody was talking about Terrifier 2 more and more for the, ongoing, duration of the month of October. So that's one thing I love about the top 10 shows is, you get to recollect on like movies that just completely caught you off guard, took you by surprise, weren't on your radar at all. And Terrifier 2 is one of those.
Terrifier certainly wins the buzz sweepstakes, like you said. I am so stuck in the past. Whenever I feel like watching Terrifier or Terrifier 2, I find myself watching the Claude Rains Invisible Man. How is that possible?
Because
That's
that
weird.
movie's great.
It is good.
They showed it at about 4 in the morning on TCM last night because they showed that Carl Laemmle documentary again. And if you haven't seen the Carl Laemmle documentary, they showed it a couple times in October. Besides the fact that he was in charge of Universal Pictures when his son made all the original Universal Monster films, it turns out that he helped a bunch of Jews escape Nazi Germany. And that's really what the documentary is about. So talk about your entertainment double feature. Saving Jews during World War II, followed by the Claude Rains Invisible Man. Is there anything better when you can't sleep at 4 a.m.?
Terrifier 2.
Well, you two have almost convinced me to watch it, especially when Adam was nice enough to compare it to our friend Herschel Gordon Lewis.
Well, there's nothing, I mean, there's a scene in the original Terrifier that has always turned me sort of against the original Terrifier. And I don't think there's anything in the sequel that's as ugly as that. For as much as that one sequence in Terrifier 2 goes on and on, I don't think it's ever as ugly or as mean-spirited as that scene in the first Terrifier. And it's funny because the first Terrifier, I think, tries to subvert the final girl trope by making us think it's this one person for most of the movie and then kind of pulling the rug out and saying, like, actually, no, it's not. It's going to be this one. And Terrifier 2 is a testament to, like, sometimes formula works. Having an identifiable final girl that we really like and care about and can invest in works better than trying to subvert that trope.
So, Patrick and Adam, I have to ask. Obviously, I'm a little bit more old school and I don't have quite the stomach for gore as Patrick does, but I have quite the stomach for gore. Currently, where I set the bar, the thing that I almost couldn't stand in a movie, the thing that almost made me turn it off, the thing that lives in my brain rent-free and I can't get rid of. Tell me if Terrifier or Terrifier 2 crosses the line of bone tomahawk. You know what scene I'm talking about.
And before you even said the words bone tomahawk, I knew exactly what you were going to say. Don't see Terrifier.
Really?
Yes.
It's
But
worse?
I think both of them are worse.
you think Terrifier 2 is?
You're kidding.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I compared it to Herschel Gordon Lewis, but that's if you're in tune with the humor of it. But if you're not, it's really ugly, like no matter what.
And it's worse than Bone Tomahawk.
I think so.
I think the
Especially that
first one is. I wouldn't say the second one is, but Adam disagrees.
I think that sequence that
Holy
you mentioned,
shit.
I think that sequence that you mentioned, Patrick, that sort of gore centerpiece,
Yeah.
I think is bothers me more in Terrifier 2 than what you mentioned in Terrifier 1.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
We could tell you off mic, J Bones.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Terrifier 2 is very exciting just as a horror fan. You know, it's like one of the big success stories of the year. I had my ticket to go see it. It was supposed to show for one night. It was going to show on a Thursday night as like a Fathom event. And I had my ticket to go see it. And then I got a screener. And so I canceled it because I was like, it's going to be me and three other people because who could give a shit about Terrifier? And then I was so upset that I didn't get the chance to see this in a theater, particularly that opening night when the ticket sales were so high that like they continued it throughout the month of October. So it would have been this huge enthusiastic crowd, and it would have been like the opening of Scream 2. And I'm bummed that I didn't see it that way.
I saw it about a week after that, because they did extend it, and it kind of did have like an opening night of Scream 2 type of vibe to the
Yeah.
theater, where it was mostly like 20 somethings, 30 somethings there, and like we were all just kind of like laughing at the end of it, where it's just like, I can't believe what I just watched. Like, it's just so not in like a transgressive way, even, because I think the movie wants you to have fun. It's just in such a like roller coaster way, like we really just went through that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm excited to spend Flashback Weekend with you, just meeting Terrifier 2 stars all weekend.
And my special 4K is on the way from Best Buy because that's the only place you can get the 4K of Terrifier 2.
Very nice. Yeah.
My number three is a movie that J Bones, you already mentioned, and that is Michael Bay's Ambulance, a movie that has only risen in my estimation throughout the year. I saw it back in April when it was released with Charlie and really liked it. But it was like that kind of thing where it was like, that was a good movie. Let's get dinner. And now looking back on the year, I appreciate it more and more when I compare it to other things that I've seen, which isn't to say that it's a bad year for movies. It just has been a bad year for movies that speak to me. I rewatched it on Blu-ray and was just so appreciating the filmmaking that went into it. You know, I'm not necessarily a Michael Bay fan, and that was one of the things that probably turned me off a little bit around its release was the sort of reconsideration of Michael Bay as a filmmaker online, where it was like, he's a master and he always has been. And I'm kind of like, he knows how to shoot, but he's a garbage storyteller, you know? But I think he does a really good job telling a story here in a movie that's about something. That's sort of about like a lot of the movies that we're talking about, like Emily the Criminal or even Glass Onion or a couple of the other movies that we've mentioned, sort of about economic anxiety and what that can drive us to do. It's a great heist movie. It's a great action movie. Jake Gyllenhaal gives a pretty wild performance. It's shot better than almost any other movie this year. Again, he's doing amazing things with drone photography, and I just so appreciate that he really put function over form for maybe the first time as a filmmaker, or at least the first time in a long time, that he.
I can see that. A measure of how great I think this film is that I'm watching it, and it has a heist scene that I would argue rivals the heist scene in Heat, which most people hold up as the new gold standard. But when the heist is over, I had occasion to hit the button on the remote to show me how much was left. And there's a boatload of story that's, I mean, the
We're
heist
not
is not
even
even
in the ambulance yet.
Oh,
Well, right.
okay.
The heist is not in the middle of the film. He's got a
It's
whole
like the
bunch
inciting
more.
incident.
Yeah, there's so much more going on that's going to happen. And He keeps all the balls in the air at the same time. At no point are you like, what, it doesn't feel drawn out. It's like you're not saying, when is this going to end? You mentioned the drone photography. My one quibble is there's all these bird's eye view shots from way at the top of buildings that then dive crazily towards the street. And then we're back where the action of the film is. Mm-hmm. I couldn't quite figure out what the purpose of those was.
Could be just like a new way of doing an establishing shot that he just sort of wanted to challenge himself with.
I think you might be right, because it does work that way, but mm-hmm. it also has the unintended benefit of constantly suggesting there's a whole bunch of other things going on in this city as well, mm-hmm. because it's such a big city. One thing I gave it credit for is, because I just moved here, it is very realistic in its portrayal of LA, because there are very few sequences where we don't see the homeless in the background. It's everywhere in ambulance. And I gave them a lot of credit for like not cleaning it up, or I don't know if it's a real homeless tent city or if they set that up for the movie or something, but amazing performances, amazing editing. It's the action film of the year.
Yeah. I mean, I there's a few big action movies that I haven't seen, so I don't know. Like, I haven't seen RRR yet. One of the things that always comes between me and Michael Bay is his need to be funny, and his way of being funny is usually to be racist and or misogynist. And he toned
Did Michael
that
Bay
all
direct Pain and Gain?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He toned all that way, way down to where I maybe had one or two sort of eye-rolly moments. And they weren't, you know, hateful in the way that his movies often are. They just, like, when he tries to be funny, I'm rolling my eyes a little bit. But I just thought this movie was really solid from start to finish.
Yeah, yeah. I really liked the arc of the Aiza Gonzalez character. Mm-hmm. Like, I very rarely get, like, kind of, I know, like, you know, Michael Bay, like, whether it be Armageddon or Pearl Harbor, he wants to be kind of a tear-jerking director.
Right.
And I was stunned, like, at the, I don't like the movie as much as you guys, but as I was watching it, I was, like, shocked at this movie where I'm just like, yeah, I don't know, like, 3 stars. And then, like, at the end of it, I'm just like, she went back to the hospital. And it just, like, snuck up on me. And then the end credits were disturbingly short. And that's what I remember.
There's a surgery scene in the movie that for me was harder to watch than anything in Terrifier 2, which again speaks to like how I can handle cartoon gore versus how I can handle realistic gore. I don't do well with realism.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly the first time in a movie where I've seen surgery being performed in an ambulance during a high-speed chase. You mm-hmm. have to give the film credit for uniqueness.
Yeah, absolutely. Which brings us to the big two, the top two, JB.
The big two. I was primed to like this film because its 2 stars appeared on every talk show known to man as a double act. And they were so charming together, they made you want to see the film. Although maybe what made you want to see the film is the fact that In Bruges is a masterpiece. My number two film is The Banshees of Inisherin. And talk about a triumph of writing. I mean, obviously the performances are beyond peer, but the writing is so clever. During the entire film, I just sat there and I thought, I can't think of another film with a premise like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's so simple, and yet it's so profound. I'm not spoiling anything. One day, an older man decides he doesn't want to be friends anymore with someone else who lives in the town. My God.
Yeah.
But if you're listening to this, you might think to yourself, as I did, to anyone who has friends, what would that be like? And then the film follows a natural or unnatural progression because again, we could classify this film under the other films on our lists of films that went there and we weren't sure if they were, because Dom Hall Gleason tells Colin Farrell,
Brendan
Gleeson, if you don't stop pestering me, I'm going to do something. And the pestering continues. Mm-hmm. And Gleason does it. And that surprised me. It surprised me that the film played out. Although I have to say, my favorite moment in the film is when Colin Farrell complains to his sister that Gleason called him boring, and his sister begins to yell at him and says, "You are boring. You are."
Yeah.
And he is. But talk about how real talented people and artists can turn the simplest of things into something very profound. I think this film is very profound in a very clever and sneaky way.
Yeah, I have it on my list too at 10, and I'm glad that it's so high on your list. I felt very similarly to you where, it's just, it's a concept that's kind of amazing that it's never been in a movie before. But like, it's something so universal, and like, it's just right in front of our faces. Cause like how many, like I, and I mentioned this to Patrick when we were doing Seen Anything Good Lately on a previous show. And I said something to the effect of, you know, I've been the Colin Farrell character and I've been the Brendan Gleeson character. Like I've broken up with friends and I've had people drop me. And I know it's because I hate to invoke this because it's being used about like people like shitheads like Kanye West and stuff recently, but like there is a truism that hurt people hurt people, and Colin Farrell wouldn't behave the way that he is unless he was so taken aback by somebody denying his or refuting his existence. Like it's just like the most personal pushback. It's I don't like you, I don't like who you are. I want nothing to do with you. And there's like nothing more kind of personally damaging to that. And then like Colin Farrell's doing these things where in a vacuum, you know, like he warns off that one guy where he's just like, you know, your parents are sick or something like that. And he sends him off the island. And then he tells Barry Keoghan, and Barry Keoghan's like so upset. Like, how could you do this? And like, it's something that he thought and the audience almost thought is kind of like this comedic lark, this sort of like funny beat. And then it's like when it's reflected back to you, it's like this is behavior with consequences. It's like really horrible. And every time, you know, I hear or see clips or hear lines from this movie back like on Twitter or people discussing it, it just makes me like the movie even more. I forgot about that scene between Carrie Condon and Barry Keoghan at the lake. And
yeah,
that I think is the most heartbreaking line delivery that he has, kind of in response to accepting the situation that
the whole
I can
way,
remember the movie.
The whole way his subplot is handled between his relationship with his father and how everyone treats him and obviously his ultimate destiny is another measure of how great the film is, because we have this subplot that's equal in dramatic weight to the main plot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He should have eaten spaghetti at some point.
Do they have much spaghetti in Ireland? I don't know.
I don't know, but I feel like if you have Barry Keoghan in a movie, you put a plate of spaghetti in front of him and you let him eat it.
You also need somebody whose legs atrophied crawling downstairs.
This is something I need to explore, because I think, as I've discussed before, I thought I was Italian, and then I did Ancestry.com, and it turns out I'm only Italian for the food, and I'm actually English, Scottish, and Irish. So I need to explore that aspect of my personality. But at the same time, I need to keep all 10 of my fingers.
Does the movie follow? I wasn't tracking it as I was watching it, but does it follow like the stages of grief exactly?
I'd have to think about it.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
that was kind of in my mind after I finished it. I was like, oh, it seems like he kind of went through all the different stages of grief.
I think you might shock, be on something.
Shock, denial, anger.
Anger, denial. I know this from All That Jazz because they keep repeating it. Anger, bargaining, denial, is one. Bargaining, acceptance.
Acceptance
is the last one.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just a thought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't even know that it was like an allegory for the Irish Civil War.
Yeah, I didn't either until I read that somewhere. And I was like, oh, there's so much I don't know.
Yeah, but not, I mean, like, just even looking at it that way, it's just like one day you're buddies and then the next day you're sworn enemies. And it's just really kind of remarkable how they do it. And I agree with you, John. Like, I was a huge fan of In Bruges, and I was afraid that I was never going to have that Martin McDonagh movie again because I sort of did it. I thought Seven Psychopaths was fine, but I don't ever think about it. And I absolutely hated Three Billboards. So, like, I'm really happy to have another one.
Three Billboards is problematic. You should revisit Seven Psychopaths.
Okay.
There's a lot to like.
Yeah.
All right, Adam, we are at your number two.
My number
two is actually your number nine.
It's actually my honorable
very
mention.
Confusing.
Mind Cage? No, it's not. my number two is The Menu, which I think, Patrick, you had on your list too.
Yeah, somewhere, maybe five, I think.
Yeah. I think The Menu is it's another one of those movies that was just such a pleasant surprise for me this year because I saw the trailer to death, like, in theaters, and I dreaded it almost as much as wanted to see it because I was just like, God damn it. Like, if there's any subject that I agree with that I hate still seeing in a movie is Eat the Rich. Like, I get it. I'm on your side. I don't care. Like,
right.
But this movie's just so much better than its trailer because I thought by the trailer, I thought it was going to be kind of this quirk fest, and it's not. It's like a really sort of dread-induced horror movie at its heart. I think that using food as a subject, it doesn't have to be food. It could be an allegory for movies or really any other kind of art, and the weird relationship between appreciators and consumers and creators. And I think it has a lot to say about it and a lot of, like, ugly truths about certain things, where it's like, if you're a creator of something, sometimes if somebody, like, compliments you, like, that's the last thing you want to hear. It's like, oh God, just get over it. Or, like, why is this so important to you and stuff like that. And I don't know. I think, like, sort of the cult aspect of it with Ralph Fiennes and his kitchen staff is just inherently creepy. I really don't deal well with, like, that aspect of horror. So it really kind of got under my skin. And I just think that, I love, not to spoil anything, but I kind of love, like, where the thesis of, like, what Anya Taylor-Joy says to Ralph Fiennes at the end, because if you're looking at this as sort of like a meta commentary on movies, it's like, sometimes you just want ambulance. Sometimes you don't want, you know, this highfalutin film comments, like, burying down your throat, like, art piece. And I think it's really funny too. I mean, like, the whole describing the ingredients of the individual portions of the menu, especially the Nicholas Holt one, is hilarious. But also, like, where that kind of goes next is terrifying too. Terrifying three. No, but I just really, like, was surprised how much The Menu got to me. I've mentioned it to you before. In life, one time, like, I was in a Jewel Osco, and, like, something absolutely, like, horrifying happened to me, where, like, a crazy woman, like, was just, like, following me and, like, berating me, and I was looking around the store for help, and everybody was acting like I was the crazy one. And no movie's ever given me that feeling again until I saw The Menu, where something is inherently upsetting, but everybody's gaslighting you and saying, like, no, this is part of a plan, or this is you just sit down, it'll make sense soon and stuff when you know that something's off. And it's a real feat of filmmaking to kind of make something feel so ill in your gut like that.
I knew nothing really about the menu because I hadn't been to a movie in months. Everything I watched was at home, and so I never saw a trailer for it. All I saw was a poster and a title, and I knew that you liked it after you saw it, and I was really excited to see it. So watching it unfold, knowing so little, was a really special experience. I thought Nicholas Hoult was so funny. It's certainly the blackest comedy of the year. I mean, it's really, really dark, but it's really funny. And I found out after the film that, the writers and directors worked on like Succession and Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, and that made so much sense. Everything kind of clicked into place in terms of what the movie is about and the way that it goes about it. Amazing cast, great performances, just really smart writing, and just where is this going, and obviously we'll have more to say about this, but Adam, I love your thesis about like sometimes you just want ambulance, or this was the year of sometimes you just want a cheeseburger, like Top Gun Maverick and a movie that's still coming up. And I miss, just solid functional Hollywood filmmaking, and some movies really brought that back this year. And the menu reminds me of that.
I
I heard
haven't.
somebody say,
just re real quick, I just had a question for Patrick. I heard somebody say that this is sort of the best, like, EC Comics Tales from the Crypt type movie. Did you see that when you were watching it?
I mean, at times maybe, but I don't know if overall I would describe it tonally or even thematically that way.
It never really goes that disturbing for me. So,
Right.
like, I think, like, premise-wise, you could definitely see it be like a What's Cooking type of episode, but
Sure.
it would never go this hard.
For me, the most EC Comics moment of the year was the car crusher at the end of Halloween Ends, where the entire town is going to line up to witness. Gentlemen, I haven't seen the menu yet, but allow me to explain to you what a dunce I am. For I am a dunce. When I moved here, I instantly went to the movies because I love the movies, and that's something I can do here and that I did at home. And then I feel less homesick if I go to the movies. And at the theater that's closest to my house in July, they had all these posters up for the menu featuring the different performers. And I looked at them, but I guess I wasn't really looking at them. I was sort of glancing at them because the conclusion I reached was that the menu was a fake movie and that these posters were somehow a promotion for the theater. Right? This went on for months because the poster stayed up. And then one fateful day, they showed me the trailer for the menu. And I said, what? It's a real movie?
You just kept waiting for a cell phone to ring and it to for it to be like, silence your phones.
It was watching that trailer, it was like one of the movies in Funny People came to life. Because for months, I was saying, oh, the Regal theater chain got these actors to sign off on this. That was quite a feat. I'm a dunce.
Which leads me to my number one movie of the year, Movie Nachos.
So I haven't seen it yet. It's on my list, and I know way too much about it. So I wish I could have seen it going in knowing nothing.
It's
It will
on
be on,
HBO Max on January 3rd.
yeah, next week.
Thank you. You
Yeah.
just saved me a couple bucks.
Yeah. Is this my two?
Yes.
Yeah.
My two is The Fabelmans,
Nice.
which Adam was your eight.
Yeah, I think it's the only movie on all three of our lists.
And it was my nine.
Okay.
I
Yeah,
know Rob,
it's
and I know Rob liked it a lot too.
yeah. It's a great movie by a great director. What the hell do I say about it? I was sold a movie about the magic of movies, and there's certainly some of that, though not as much as, say, in Babylon. But it's much more about heartbreak, and it's sort of a coming of age movie about finding your way to understand the world, and the way Spielberg chooses to understand the world is through art. He's still in the process of doing it, because making The Fabelmans is his way of understanding his parents in a way that we've never seen before. So he's processing things still in his 70s. I'm not fully sold on the performances of Paul Dano and Michelle Williams. Less so Michelle Williams. She makes some very specific choices. I loved Seth Rogen as Benny. The last scene is obviously one of the greatest scenes in any movie this year.
Seth Rogen is one of the highlights of the film. I too had a problem with the Michelle Williams performance, because it seemed to me as if she really wanted an Oscar nomination. But as time went on, I thought it was a very canny choice, because that's clearly how that character sees herself. And so if we think the Michelle Williams performance is a little bit more theatrical than everyone else in the film and it doesn't fit, it's because the mother is this.
She's a flibbertigibbet.
Or because that's how Spielberg sort of projects her or remembers her as being.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I liked all the movie stuff, including all of the stuff showing him editing, because I remember doing that in high school, and how wonderful it was to touch the film and smell the film and glue it together. And there's even a scene where he's comforted by the sound of the camera, even though there's no film in it. He's running the mechanism on the camera to sort of settle himself down. The thing I like the most, though, and this goes back to what I said earlier about films showing us complicated ambiguity, is that when he volunteers to film Senior Ditch Day, and he makes the bully look like an idiot, but he also makes the other bully look different. Mm-hmm. And that bully is also made angry by that. I thought this is something very specific that we haven't seen in movies. The Spielberg character has made this high school asshole look like a hero, and it destroys him.
Mm-hmm.
It's really something, and it's not simplistic, and it's not stupid. And I don't want to be a spoiler, because it's clear the film itself has been trying to keep this a secret. But at the end of the film, the Spielberg character talks to someone. And I think that's the scene of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like what Patrick, you said about Spielberg using the Fabelmans to process even more his parents' divorce and just their dynamic. And I think that the movie kind of elegantly uses the him trying to recreate the train crash from the
Greatest Show on Earth.
Because it's like he needs everything to be on his terms. He needs to break it down. He needs to like study it until it makes sense to him in his own specific way. And I thought it was so interestingly bookended by the scene where, you know, his parents are announcing their divorce to the children. And, you know, Julia Butters is one of the daughters, and like the other daughters are like visibly upset by it. And then like you see Steven Spielberg as a teenager, and he kind of has this like disassociation where like you see a reflection in a cabinet of him like shooting it. And it's like, he can't be in that moment. His first impulse is like, how would I make this cinematic in a way like that? And it kind of just really works well with the Judd Hirsch speech to him and with his relationship with his mom, where it's like they know just kind of inherently they have, you know, against their better judgment, like this selfish streak, like they have this one track mind about certain things. And I thought that it was like really kind of brave to sort of just have that as almost like a confessional. And I really liked how, you know, John, kind of what you were saying with like the one bully that he makes look really good. It's like he knows that would make a better movie, even though like it's against his, you know, better judgment. Like he knows what will work for an audience, and that's mm-hmm. why he's doing it. And he even like maybe isn't even aware of that. But then I love how the movie kind of speaks to other movies in Spielberg's filmography. Like I thought that this movie like really kind of recontextualizes Catch Me If You Can in a lot of interesting ways. Certainly like his attitude towards like fighting back against anti-Semites and stuff like Raiders of the Lost Ark. And it doesn't do it in a way where it's like he's making out with the Catholic girl and she's just like easy jaws. It's not like anything like that. You know what I mean? There's no like cutesy bullshit like that.
We'll
so,
call
like,
you Han Solo.
Yeah. So no, I thought the movie was so good. I had one of the most interesting experiences watching it because I pocket dialed 911 during the end credits because it was an emergency. I needed to make sure that people didn't make them the cable men's and rushed out to see the
It's too bad you didn't pocket dial 911 during the end credits for ambulance, because the credits would have ended before the phone stopped ringing.
This is true. Yeah.
You mentioned Julia Butters. It was great to see her playing a part that was very different than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. I think some people might have a problem with the Judd Hirsch performance, but I thought it was pitch perfect, especially the things that he is given to say.
You're expecting Armageddon time, like all of the sort of a little bit cliche speeches that Anthony Hopkins gives to his grandson in that movie. You're expecting Judd Hirsch to come in and give the sage advice and say, follow your dreams and, you know, and be the loving grandpa. But it's sort of the rantings of a madman. Mm-hmm. And he's saying art will break your heart and yet you have to do it. Art will destroy you and yet you have to do it. It's so, so interesting. There's so many things in the movie that I just am so fascinated by, and the way that Spielberg, you know, again, that they even come out and say it, which I kind of wish they wouldn't. At one point, Michelle Williams talks about him filming the train sequence or rewatching it again and again, and then filming it where she's like, oh, that's how he's getting control of it. And it's like, we got that without you spelling it out, Michelle Williams, but that's fine. But that's sort of what this whole movie is about. And it's Spielberg almost acknowledging that he's unable to control the narrative of what happened in his family. Even in this movie can't contain it, even though it's an attempt to sort of contain it, that it's just too messy. I just think it's a great and deeply, deeply personal movie from somebody who's never gotten that personal. You know, I mean, there's personal touches in so many of his movies, but for him to make a movie that reflects on his own life so specifically, and it helps, you know, he's working again with Tony Kushner, who he's worked with on the last few movies. And I think their collaboration has been pretty incredible.
Yes.
I was really blown away by it.
Yeah, this is one of those movies. Sorry, go ahead, John.
I think I've said this before on the podcast that for at least the last 10 and maybe the last 20 years, people seem to regard Spielberg in a different way, that the bar is somehow higher. Because Patrick mentioned Catch Me If You Can, which is an amazing film. And I'm also thinking of Bridge of Spies. And he turns out these masterpieces, and yet somehow they don't get talked about as if a first-time filmmaker had done them. It's like Spielberg is in a different category where he has to cure cancer to get attention, because everyone assumes that his films are going to be good. What's the recent film about the Washington Post?
The Post.
That film was amazing for about six different reasons and really well made. And it just, it's like it comes to be what people expect. And I think he deserves more accolades.
Yeah, I find it interesting that I think a lot of people who aren't like fully on board with Spielberg categorize him as sort of like this milquetoast, like do-gooder, like Americana type of director. And I think The Fablemans does a better job of almost any movie of his in kind of showing that mercenary streak that he has in him. And like there's a lot of darkness beneath the surface. And it's interesting that he casts, you know, a certain director in that final scene, because it's like that guy's full MO is like Everything looks cheery on top, but it's
Right.
like kind of dark and rotten to the core on the bottom. And I don't know. I just kind of like, I like Spielberg even more kind of after watching The Fablemans, which I didn't think was possible.
We're very lucky to be, again, living at a time where Spielberg is still working and producing new films that are great. I've been reflecting a little bit on like Saving Private Ryan because its 25th anniversary will be coming up next year. And I remember for a long time, I considered Saving Private Ryan to be late period Spielberg. And yet we'll be further away, I think, from Saving Private Ryan next year than it was from Jaws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's like middle Spielberg, which is fascinating because I was like, well, he got dark near the end, but no, he got dark in the middle and now he's reflective in this way. We're just very fortunate that some of the greatest filmmakers of the last, you know, 50 to 100 years are still producing great films.
Yep. Yes.
Which brings us to our number ones, our favorite movies of 2022. JB, you now, are first.
Okay. I've now figured out what yours is. I don't think I figured out what Adam's is. After much soul searching, my number one film of the year is Nope, the Jordan Peele film, which does a whole bunch of stuff very well. Some people were put off by its length. I was not, because of course this was the year that every movie was 3.5 hours
That's exactly
long.
Right.
It took me a little while after I saw it to sort of puzzle out what I thought of it and what I thought it was about. But Nope does an extraordinary job being a film that sort of pretends to be an entertainment about this. But I think what Nope is actually about is trauma. And it speaks a lot of truth about trauma and the way that people process traumas in various ways. Amazing performances, amazing cinematography. One shot that I've talked about many times in the context of this website, I would argue is the single scariest shot of the year in an American film. It just blew me away.
Nice. I certainly can see what you're talking about in terms of the trauma. For me, it was a movie about exploitation and who is exploited and how they are exploited.
Oh, sure.
And how Hollywood in particular. I think it's a better movie about Hollywood exploitation than, say, again, not to pile on this movie, something like Babylon, which tries to be about Hollywood exploitation. I think Nope says it better and in a more interesting way. I still need to revisit Nope. I've only seen it the one time. I didn't really connect to it except for all the, is it Gordy?
Yeah.
All the Gordy stuff I thought was like some of the best stuff in any movie this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that he opens the movie with that too, that he has the courage to do that. Obviously, you know, Jordan Peele is a very exciting filmmaker. And even though I've been mixed on his last two movies, I'll be there opening day for anything he makes. So I'm really excited that you picked that as your number one. All right, that's it. Then Adam.
My number one is Pearl. And it's the movie that I mentioned why X got bumped down a couple pegs. And it's because where I think X makes Pearl even better, I think Pearl hurts X a little bit because now I can't watch X as other than a Pearl movie.
Sure.
If that makes sense. So it sort of takes away a bit of the shine of the slasher thing. And I'm so hyper focused on what Mia Goth's doing, which it's still on my list. It's still a really good movie.
Yeah.
Pearl, though, I just think, you know, the performance of the year for me was Mia Goth in Pearl. I just think she's so amazing at kind of alternating between, you know, funny and carefree and sexy and like just scary as all get out in the top of a hat. Some of the whole conceit of it, I think, is really cool, where it's this Technicolor Wizard of Oz by way of Douglas Sirk sort of thing on the surface, but then the subject matter is Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, it's really horrifying. And I think the movie just kind of, the thing that took it up to number one for me are the combination of like the 1-2 punch of her monologue at the end, and then the final shot of her with that grin over the end credits. I think it's so interesting just kind of as a character study, because I always heard kind of the adage, it's like crazy people don't know that they're crazy. But the thing that's interesting about Pearl is she knows she's crazy, but it's like a compulsion, and she thinks she can control it when she really can't. And just like, I find it so fascinating where she's that horrible, like, and I mean horrible by like, it's so stressful sequence where she's talking to her sister-in-law, and it's like, her sister-in-law's reacting to this like any of us would, just like, how do I get out of here without upsetting her? And it's just happening in like drips and drabs where, she's just like, no, it's cool, like, I'm happy for you. And then on the drop of a dime, her true nature, she can't help it. It just busts out, the jealous rage that Pearl has. And then I just think the implications of that final shot are so fascinating, let alone the performance of it. It's just like, wow, that guy stayed with her. I just find that so fascinating. And like, I'm just like, how, and I'm just like thinking about it in my head, and maybe this is a plot hole, I'm like, that was his sister. Like, how'd she explain that one away? How is Pearl like invited over for Thanksgiving and shit like that? But like, I just think that the movie is truly remarkable. It's one of my favorite horror movies of recent years. It reminded me of May, which is one of my favorite horror movies of all time. And I just love character studies in the genre, and I think this is a really special one.
Adam, I love what you said about do crazy people know they're crazy. I think one movie line I quote more than most others is Woody Harrelson to Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men. Do you know how crazy you are?
No.
You wake up in the morning and know that you're crazy?
No.
Pearl is great. It's probably my favorite horror movie of the year, which I guess we'll get to next week, but it's either that or X. Honestly, I really love them both. And I love how different they are from one another, even though they sort of focus on the same character. Ty West just goes stylistically completely different. I love how much he cares about the character of Pearl. I love how much we care about the character of Pearl, which only makes X that much sadder, I think, and makes me so nervous for like Maxine, because I only want good things for Maxine, and I don't want anything bad to happen to her in the next movie. It's beautiful to look at. It has my three favorite end credits ranked. Number three, White Noise for the year, I should say. Number three, White Noise. Number two, A Wounded Fawn. And number one, Pearl, because again, you just can't believe how sort of audacious it is. It's a great choice.
I really like to, I forgot to mention this, like, you think that Pearl almost is the way that she is because, she's got this, she's a flighty, like, daydreamer, and you think that like the world is beating her down because of her domineering mother. And then there's that great moment where she has that confrontation with her mother before like this inciting incident, and her mom's just like, no, I'm protecting the world from how awful you are. Like, it's not, it's like, I know how bad you are, and like, I'm protecting everyone about that. That's why you can't live out your dreams. And it's such like a just a fun development in kind of quotes, and such a gut punch in a way too.
J Bones, you haven't seen Pearl still, right?
I have not seen it yet.
You should see it. It's good. It's Adam's favorite movie of the year.
Like you do.
This is what I've been told.
My number one by process of elimination, everybody sort of knows what it is. It's Avatar: The Way of Water. And again, this is a movie that, like, I don't love when people, start talking about a movie by saying, like, it's not a perfect movie. But let's face it, Avatar The Way of Water is not a perfect movie. As anybody who listened to our Patreon episode knows, I have issues with the movie. But in trying to choose a number one, I was like, well, I got to be honest with myself. And a year from now or 5 years from now, which 2022 movie am I going to be revisiting the most? Which one is going to be living with me still in a way that maybe these nine other movies aren't?
Babylon?
It's Babylon. And but I couldn't put it on this list.
So Mind I Cage? Went with
Avatar The Way of Water, a.k.a. Mind Cage. Because the Tulkun are kept in a mine cage. Again, like the Fablemans, we're very fortunate to be living through James Cameron as a filmmaker who continues to push the possibilities of cinema forward and is doing it at a time in a way where his stories are very archetypal and traditional. There are things about the narrative choices and the storytelling in Avatar The Way of Water that I like better than the first movie, and then there's stuff in the first movie that I like better than Way of Water, but that doesn't matter. What matters is, again, like Top Gun Maverick, like some other movie that we mentioned, it's a very, very formally functional narrative, which I like, because that gives James Cameron then license to go wild with the visuals and really, you know, there's something I miss about the original Avatar, the sort of transformation story, because it gives us a grounding point where Jake Sully begins as a human and becomes a Na'vi. Whereas in this movie, he's all in on Na'vi. And so there are almost no human characters in this movie. So maybe we're not as grounded, but I appreciate just how far in he goes into this world, introducing us to new characters, to new species of life on this moon. It's technically not a planet. The action is some of the best in a movie this year. You know, when we get to that final action set piece, really James Cameron can't be topped when it comes to just holy shit action. It's pretty incredible, but I'm down with the previous 2 hours too, where it's just kind of a hangout movie on Pandora. So again, I know it is a film that has flaws. I know it's a movie that doesn't work as well for everybody as it does for me, but I also know that I don't want to regret not putting it at number one. If that makes sense.
I had it on my list too. I like it even more than the original. I'm eager to see it a second time. I saw it in Dolby Digital 3D, so I want to see it in IMAX 3D before it leaves those screens and gets taken over by like House Party or something.
I think you have until Quantum Mania, because I don't think anything's going to bump it from IMAX in that.
Yeah,
time.
I hope so. I mean, because like I was reading like amongst the box office reports that like it's over-indexing, not surprisingly, like in the premium formats. Like that's how most people are seeing it. So, but yeah, I love just the ocean side of Pandora and like just the characters from there. And you know, I joked on the Patreon show, once I saw that it's partly about a boy and a space whale, I was like, goner. Like, it was my jam. And then I just think it's so brave how he takes the protagonists of the first movie and kind of makes them supporting characters and makes us, like, kind of grow to love this whole new set of children. And they become almost the leads, or, like, sort of the heart of the movie, at the very least. And I liked them all to an alien and a person. And I just really, you know, I think at the heart of it, I just love how square and sincere these movies are. I saw a tweet that I kind of quote tweeted recently where somebody posited, you know, is it because of Top Gun Maverick and Avatar, like, are the 2020s for the remainder of the decade going to bring back sincerity, and it's going to be less about irony? And I sure hope so. If these two movies being the top two, you know, Top Gun and Avatar being the two highest grossing movies of the year, are any indication in if the trend is that like people want heart back in their blockbusters, then I am indebted to them, and I'm thankful for them even more than I am right now.
Yeah. Any honorable mentions you guys want to bring up before we run down our lists again?
I have some. John, do you want to go first?
No, that's the reason why I didn't quite think this year was quite as good as some previous years. I have no also-ran.
And mine would kind of be the movies that you guys named that I didn't, you know, like either because I'm going to talk about them on next week's show or because they didn't quite make my list, but everything you guys named, I'm down with.
My honorable mentions are in no particular, just in alphabetical order. I have Elvis, the House of Darkness, I Love My Dad, The Northman, and Spin Me Round, with special Spotlight Showcase jury prizes to Mind Cage and Samaritan.
I watched I Love My Dad last night thinking it was going to maybe appear on your list. Mm-hmm. And you and I were texting about it. And I said I almost couldn't get through it because it is so uncomfortably awkward.
Yeah, I just really like Patton Oswalt in things like Big Fan and I Love My Dad, where he plays just kind of bottom dwellers. I think he's so good at that.
He picks great projects.
Yeah.
All right, Jay Bones, you want to go through your list 10 to 1 one more time?
My number 10 was a tie between Men and Resurrection. My number 9 film was The Fabelmans. 8 is Tar. 7 is Weird, The Al Yankovic Story. Number 6 is Ambulance, and capitalize the L and the A in the middle of that word. Mm-hmm. Thank you. My number 5 is Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery, and one of Patrick's least favorite titles of the year. My number 4 is Confess Fletch. Number 3, Emily the Criminal. Number 2, The Banshees of Inisherin. And number 1, Nope.
All right, Adam.
Number 10, The Banshees of Inisherin. Number 9, Top Gun Maverick. Number 8, Emily the Criminal. Number 7, Avatar, The Way of Water. Number 6, X. Number 5, Armageddon Time. Number 4, Terrifier 2. Number 3, The Menu. Number 2, The Fabelmans. Number 1, Pearl. Yes, I did change my ranking.
I was going to say, that was totally different.
That's not the one I wrote down during the course of this podcast.
Armageddon Time and The Fabelmans got Hopkins bumps in discussion.
Based on our discussions or what?
Yeah, I was like, why am I going on and on and on about The Fabelmans and it's 8? Like,
what? So it went up to 2.
Yeah, it went up to 2. And then Armageddon Time went from 7 to 4 to 5.
Dropped a spot since we talked about it.
Yeah.
All right, my list. Number 10, Violent Night. Number 9, Senior. Number 8, Resurrection. Number 7, Bones and All. Number 6, Decision to Leave. Number 5, The Menu. Number 4, Glass Onion. Number 3, Ambulance. Number 2, The Fabelmans. And number 1, Avatar, The Way of Water.
Nice.
Thanks, boys. This was fun. I always enjoy doing this show.
Yeah.
It was a year.
It was a year. We'll be running best of the year content all week at fthismovie.com. So make sure that you check back every day for more best of 22 lists. As we've mentioned previously, we do have a Patreon. If you are a fan of the show and want to subscribe for more content, go to patreon.com/fthismovie. You should also like us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube, where you'll find reserved seating every Thursday. And of course, fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com is our email address. Thanks again, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.